fish number 11245 reel 2.
Mr. Goldsworthy, reel 2.
Admiral Morgan was then Flag Officer Taranto and Liaison Italy. Della Padden went to see him and became active on the British side. He, in fact, took part in an operation to cripple a cruiser in Spezia, which was under German control. He drove one of the motorboats because he knew that area, and he took the operators into it. Prince Umberto came down to Taranto to present medals to the Italian operators working on what was then, of course, the British side. And one of the highest honour of all, the gold medal, was awaiting presentation to Della Padden for his attack upon the Valiant at Alexandria 3 years before. And Prince Umberto turned round to Admiral Morgan and said, "Here, Morgan, this is your show." And Admiral Morgan put the medal on, pinned the medal onto the man who had knocked out his own ship 3 years before, a very strange quirk of history. But Admiral Morgan was a great admirer of people like Della Padden, and we were very glad to have them working on our side. But that, by the way, is not a personal memory of mine. I, in fact, learned about that at the Imperial War Museum. I saw a letter from the Admiral, which is on display there. And when I wrote about Cuban torpedo operations later for a series which appeared in the Sunday Express, I submitted it to the Admiralty, and they were prepared to clear everything, but the chap who was having to scrutinize it was a man called Mervyn Ellis, who had been in the commission class with me years before. And he came on the phone to me and he said, "Look, Frank, I can clear pretty well all of this, but I don't think you should say this business about the men being put down in the bottom of the ship to try and make them talk. That is, of course, a breach of the Geneva Convention." So I said, "Well, in that case, if you want to take that out, Mervyn, you better tell the Admiral to take his letter down for a display in the Imperial War Museum, because that's where I got it." So he said, "All right, you'll have to let it go." And now there is a point there, of course. It was quite a contravention. But I must say that if I were the captain of a battleship with the lives and safety of some 1,500 men before me, I think I would have been prepared to break that rather than say, "Well, I'm not allowed to do it." It could just have made all the difference. But I would also think that the Admiral had the courage to make it perfectly plain afterwards what he had done. He didn't shirk it at all.
Can you tell me more about your own work at Gibraltar from in the 42-44 period?
In the time we were there, a lot of this was routine work. As far as I was concerned, most of the time, I used to go on duty every second night and go on at about 6 in the evening and on duty till 8 o'clock the following morning. Locked up in the office there, I could read, I could sleep if things were quiet, but in the meantime I was reading all the signals that came in, the signalman brought them to me, and if there was anything that I thought required action, then I would either take it myself, or more likely I would ring the commander, who was the staff officer of intelligence, to the station to alert him. And a matter of routine, a lot of this stuff is. On the other hand, there were also things which were not routine, which I got involved in, and they rather used me, because being a journalist by profession, I could prepare reports of proceedings and accounts of what was happening and so on.
So Gibraltar was on the limits of range for Italian bombers, and air raids were very few and ineffective. But there was one constant silent threat to the shipping at Gibraltar, which exacted a high toll in actual damage and a vast expenditure of man-hours in defence vigilance. It came from the human torpedo operators and the swimming limpeteers of the Italian Navy, operating 1,000 miles from their home bases. Striking by night and at long intervals, they crippled 14 merchant ships, totaling some 73,000 tons. Those intacts involved a long chronicle of deception and intrigue and outrageous violations of Spanish neutrality, but each demanded skill and daring which would have won respect in any navy in the world. This threat first revealed itself in October 1940, when, as you know, a submarine commanded by Prince Valerio Borghese penetrated far into Gibraltar Bay and released 3 human torpedoes. I've already explained the way these functions, the plan was that they should attack the shipping in the harbour. But in fact, on that particular attack, they did no damage at all. Instead, they had technical failures on all 3 human torpedoes, and they were lucky to get away by swimming onto a Spanish beach in the early morning to rendezvous with the Italian vice consul coming down from Barcelona to provide their escape route. In that October attack, one pair were captured, became prisoners of war. They refused to talk about the mission, but one of the abandoned torpedoes ran itself ashore on a Spanish beach, and British local agents got a description of it before it was taken away by the Spanish military authorities. So we then had some sort of idea of what we were had to contend with. The next attack was in May 1941, and that failed too. But in September, another visit from the Shire resulted in crippling damage to the tankers Fiona Shell and Danby Dale and the 10,000-ton motor ship Durham. Again, the crews were picked up by the consular agent and taken back to Italy. More attacks followed. In July 1942, 12 swimmers who based themselves on a shoreside Italian rented villa near La Linea damaged 4 ships with limpet bombs. 7 were arrested by Spanish police as they went ashore, but their internment was under conditions so lax that 2 of them slipped away from the hotel and made another attack on the British shipping in September of that year, sinking the Raven's Point. To counter this danger, and in particular to defend the battleships and aircraft carriers berthed from time to time inside the harbour, sentries were posted on moles.
At irregular intervals, small explosive charges with a wide concussion effect were catapulted into the water near the entrance nets. Patrol launches swept the approaches with searchlights, and near the harbour gate, they dropped charges, which often yielded a good catch of stunned fish for naval messes. Secretly, an organisation was set up to search ships' hulls when there is a suspicion that time bombs had been placed on them. Heading that group were Lieutenant Bill Bailey and Lieutenant Lionel Buster Crabb, both of whom were awarded the George Medal for dealing with enemy time bombs. At one stage, there was an appeal for volunteers, and I took some underwater training with Crabb, the same Buster Crabb whose disappearance during the Russian Navy visit to Portsmouth caused such a sensation many years later.
This was in 56 or 57, I think.
Somewhere in the mid-50s, that's right, about 56. In December 1942, the British countermeasures paid off. Of six human torpedo operators sent against the port, two were drowned in the harbour, two were made prisoner, and one vanished without trace, and only one got back to Italy. But they didn't give up. In May 1943, the nighttime invaders struck against the convoy anchorage, knocking out three ships, the Pat Harrison, the Marsud, and the Camerata, without loss to themselves. Three more ships were blown up during the night of the 3rd or 4th of August 1943. They were the Harrison Grey Otis, the Thorshovde, and the Standridge. One man was captured. 5 weeks later came the Italian armistice, and suddenly a cloak was whipped away to reveal the source of the daggers. We received an unexpected caller in the intelligence centre, the chief engineer of the Altera, an Italian ship lying alongside the mole in Algeciras harbour, unable to move because of the British blockade. Altera was scuttled in the contraband control anchorage when Italy entered the war. She lay half submerged for 18 months till the Spanish salvage firm took her into Algeciras harbour. There she was berthed, oddly enough, directly below the windows of the British consulate for a period of months. And over a period of months, she was transformed into a forward base for the Italian Navy, within sight of Gibraltar Harbour. One by one, the Merchant Navy caretaker crew were replaced by naval specialists, who were, I was told, given a special conversion course, which included acquiring a habit of spitting over the side. The main body of a human torpedo, as I've explained before, is about 14 feet long. The Italians told the Spaniards they needed new boiler tubes for the Altera. Lorries, of course, arrived with packing cases containing about a foot of boiler tubing at each end, and 14 feet of human torpedo in the middle. Explosive warheads came in drums of fuel oil consigned to the Italian consulate. Technicians and operators arrived at Barcelona as merchant seamen, or were escorted over the Franco-Spanish frontier by smugglers. In the bow of the Altera, they set up a workshop, served by a coffee stall hatch cut in a bulkhead to give access while providing cover in the event of a Spanish search. On a sunny afternoon, the ship was trimmed with the bow high in the water. While the crewmen chipped away paint on the outside to cover things, acetylene lances were cutting through the forepeak hole from the inside. when the ship resumed its normal trim, there was a hinged doorway 4 feet square through which human torpedoes and their riders could emerge from the ship underwater and return to the base after their mission. It was from this secret hideout on the night of 7th December 1942 that three torpedoes emerged, their two-man crews planning to cripple the battleship Nelson and the aircraft carriers Formidable and Furious. All failed, beaten by British countermeasures. Licio Vicentini, who had masterminded the whole Volterra plan, and his companion were killed by the routine explosive charges. Their bodies were found inside the harbour, and I had the grim task of listing their effects. When they were buried at sea, the only wreath provided was by Bailey and Crabb, the officers whose hazardous duty it was to search for and remove any bombs they might have planted. It was a generous gesture, much of us understood by those who did not appreciate the gladiatorial elements of this private underwater war. At the end of the war, Crabb went to Venice to take charge of the Italian Navy's underwater weapons experimental station near Venice. His secretary was Vicentini's young widow. The second pilot pair in that December attack was seen by a sentry, fired upon, depth charged and captured. But as prisoners, they kept Volterra's secret. Of the third pair, the leader returned to the Volterra, but his companion had vanished and his body was never found. Of course, the Volterra had been under suspicion, and at one stage, Crabb secretly put forward a plan to sink it with an underwater charge of our own. But at cabinet level, the project was vetoed for fear of diplomatic consequences. Vicentini was awarded a posthumous gold medal, the Italian equivalent of the VC, and others took over the Volterra base. Twice more, in May and August 1941, three torpedoes slid silently through the underwater trapdoor, but now they were content to attack only the merchant ships in the open anchorage. And as I have said, each sally knocked out three ships without the loss of Italian lives. Under the armistice terms, the British took over the Volterra and the other ships blockaded in Spanish harbours. When the chief engineer reported to us in Gibraltar, he revealed too that after the armistice, the Italians had learned for the first time the illicit use made of the ship. In panic, the local governor ordered the Evans should be destroyed. So when my boss commander, James, later Sir James Pike Knott, and I boarded the ship on the day it was brought out from Algeciras, we found a shambles behind the coffee stall hatch. Out in the anchorage, her stern tanks were flooded and the bow tanks pumped out till the torpedo entry port could be seen and photographed. Of course, there was then a big inquest into why we had not discovered the truth sooner. I went through all the agents' reports, but apart from one concerning the arrival of the torpedo tubes, of the boiler tubing, there was nothing to link Volterra with the attacks. The secret had been well kept. For me, there was a curious postscript to the last attack from Volterra. One of the torpedoes was driven by Lieutenant Commander Ernest Notari, who had succeeded Vicentini in command of the Volterra group. Later, when I was intelligence officer to the port party reopening Leghorn in Italy, I sought out Notari in the mountain village where he had made his home after the post-armistice breakup of the Italian underwater units. We sat together in the sunshine, perched on a wall overlooking the valley, as he took me back to the dark waters of Gibraltar Bay. Beneath his target, the American liberty ship Harrison Gray Otis, he encountered a new defense, barbed wire hanging in the darkness from the sides of the ship. He went deep to pass under it and reached the bottom of the ship. His number one was a petty officer, Giannoli, a last-minute substitute who belonged to the swimming limpeteer group and comparatively inexperienced on human torpedoes. The plan was, of course, to fasten the detachable warhead on the line beneath the ship, but Giannoli dropped the line, and the warhead was clamped direct to the port bilge keel. While this was being completed, the torpedo began to rise, threatening to break surface. Notari opened the diving valves too wide, and suddenly the torpedo plunged out of control. Lungs bursting, head splitting, Notari fumbled with the controls as the luminous depth gauge needle crept down past the 34-meter limit, three times the normal training depth. As suddenly as it had gone down, the torpedo began a wild rush to the surface. Notari expected to break his neck against the bottom of the ship, or rip his rubber suit on the shreds of the barbed wire. But with a resounding splash, he broke surface a yard from the ship's side. Half conscious, unable to think or act, he lay over the controls, expecting shouts or rifle shots. Once detected, human torpedo operators, as I've explained before, are totally defenseless. Nothing happened. Slowly he gathered his wits. Giannoli had vanished. The motor would run only at top speed, and at that speed, diving was impossible. Notari took his only slender chance, a full-speed return on the surface for nearly 4 miles, expecting any moment that the fiery sparkle of his phosphorescent wake would bring a patrol boat in pursuit. Then, to him, it seemed a miracle happened. A school of poi-pois, a sight familiar enough to us as Gibraltar yachtsmen, joined him and frolicked round him all the way to Algeciras, providing the perfect cover for his wake. He made a wide circuit to avoid the Spanish sentry on the end of the T and got back into the Alterra. Meanwhile, Giannoli, torn from his seat by the plunge of the torpedo, surfaced on the other side of the ship and thought Notari had drowned. Giannoli swam to the stern, stripped off his breathing equipment and his rubber suit, and for 2 hours shivered in his woolen combinations on the rudder of the ship. When he judged the time was right, for his comrades on the other human torpedoes to have completed their attack, he swam alongside the ship and shouted for help. He was hauled on board and his captors flashed to naval headquarters. An ML patrolling the bay hurried to the Harrison Gray Otis to collect the prisoner and search the ship. The ML tied up on the starboard side, Giannoli had been taken onto the ML, and Petty Officer Bell of the Naval Diving Party was putting his foot into the water when the 500-pound charge exploded on the other side of the ship. It blew a tremendous hole in the engine room. A piece of metal passed right through the ship and out through the starboard plates, and struck the seaman standing over Giannoli in the wheelhouse of the ML. Some years later, I wrote a series of articles for the Sunday Express telling the story of the whole Italian underwater campaign. I believed then that the seaman had died before reaching hospital, And Buster Crabbe, with whom I compared notes when I was writing the piece, had the same recollection. So I mentioned that this piece of shrapnel killed the seaman in the ML. After the article appeared in the Sunday Express in 1950, I had a letter from a reader in Scotland asking if I'd been mistaken about the sailor's death. The reader's brother had been injured on board a harbour defence motor launch at Gibraltar on the date mentioned in the article. He had spent most of the next few years in hospital and had at last got back to work as a lorry driver with a silver plate in his head. He could remember nothing of how he had been suffered the injury, and his family could not find out what had happened. The writer quoted the details of the ML flotilla, and I was able to trace and talk to the commanding officer, and it was the same man. And the Sunday Express had to run a story bringing him back to life.
What kind of a man was Buster Crabbe?
Well, of course, I knew him both in Gibraltar and later when we were at Leghorn, and I visited him up at Venice. He was a bit of a character. He was certainly a great enthusiast for this underwater work, and in that respect, a great patriot. After the war, I think he was really not a suitable man for a special operation like the one that it now seems fairly certain he engaged in. And for all the theories of what really happened when he went down to Portsmouth and tried to make some inspection of the Russian ships, my belief is that what happened to him was what more or less happened to Gianelli, that may well have felt he was being spotted and did a sudden, went deep and then came up in a panic sort of situation. Things just go wrong on this equipment. And I'm afraid I personally think that was his body which was eventually found round at Chichester. But that's a whole long story which...
Why do you say that you don't think he was suitable for this kind of special operation?
Well, by that time he was drinking too much. I don't think he was as fit as he was. He was in well into the 40s then, and it required somebody. And he was not a very discreet person in my experience, because when I was Staff Officer for Intelligence at Leghorn, I had to circulate secret papers, that information going around, and he was one of these sort of people, you just didn't return them. You'd got to go around and practically take them out of his desk. He was too casual. And, of course, all the stories that came out after he disappeared at Portsmouth was that he'd been talking too much about people, about going and having a look at the Ruskies' bottoms, which was not a wise thing to do at all. He was a great character, a likeable bloke, but there were, to my mind, the whole bloody operation at Portsmouth, to my mind, was a stupid, hazardous thing to undertake. But that's a personal view.
While you were at Gibraltar, was it when the famous North African landings took place, Operation Torch?
Yes, I was in the intelligence centre there.
Then, do you have any memories of that?
No, well, I was not involved, because it was the main memory of that was that the